This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
Robin Hitchcock is a singer-songwriter that AllMusic.com calls, quote, among alternative rock's father figures and the closest thing the genre has to a Bob Dylan. They then note that this is not surprising because Hitchcock himself claims Dylan is his biggest influence. As you'll hear in a few moments, it actually goes further, as he explains that Dylan is, musically one presumes, a part of his DNA, along with a selection of other top-tier 60s musicians and songwriters. Through a 40-year career that began leading the influential Soft Boys and has continued with revered albums ever since, Robin has put that DNA to good use with catchy, idiosyncratic, and well-crafted songs and performances. He's covered Dylan quite a lot in live performance, and in 2002, he released a double album called Robin Sings, which offers 16 compelling takes on songs ranging from Desolation Row up through Time Out of Mind's Not Dark Yet. That last song is one that Robin recently performed for us at a private show with Emma Swift. We've posted that performance to YouTube for the first time, along with the release of this podcast. You can find a link in the show notes. As with the other musicians we've talked to in this series, Robin has a deep and interesting perspective on Bob, and we talked to him about the arc of Dylan's career and his memories and observations of Time Out of Mind in the conversation that follows. Robin himself has a new album out this week called Shufflemania, which I'll highly recommend. It's not on the streaming services, however, so you'll have to jump online and order your very own LP, CD, or cassette. Links to the order page and some nice videos where you can check out a few of the songs are also in the show notes. But for now, here's our conversation with Robin Hitchcock. All right. Hello, Robin. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Craig.
I'm really happy to talk to you for a whole lot of reasons. One is you're clearly a Dylan expert of various flavors, and you've sung and covered Bob quite a lot. I'd like to hear what you thought in the period before Time Out of Mind. Did you expect something else to happen? Did you think those periods were as low as other people did?
I thought he was just increasingly unhappy. You know, my take on Dylan is that he kind of supernovaed in 66, you know, 67, and gradually kind of reassembled himself as an adult and tried to be a family man and tried to escape or transcend the position that he put himself into or the world had put himself into, you know. And then the family broke down, the marriage broke down, whatever it was, and he kind of began to repeat himself. He began to, as somebody would have said back then, revert into the same trips. So you got him going through the long hair, polka dot shirts and drugs phase, you know, again and again. But increasingly unhappily, I felt that, like, you know, street legal, really, he sounded like he was on the ropes. So that tour was good, the 78 tour. You know, he was still in good shape. He was still speaking to the audience, and his voice wasn't as sort of mangled as it became. In a lot of ways, that was one of his more satisfying appearances. But the record itself, he sounds forsaken, you know. And so when he found Jesus and God and everything, I thought he's ready for it. You know, it was as somebody said at the time, oh God, he's betrayed his fans yet again. It's his fourth betrayal. You know, he stopped doing protest songs, then he went electric, then he went country, and now he's gone Christian. You know, you can see a pattern. But I thought the Christianity kind of, it gave him a rock to stand on. It gave him an armature to base his life around. You know, when you've been the most important person in the world for 15 years and everybody's looked at you going, wow, Craig, where's it at? You know, or, hey, Robin, you know, tell us how should we live? You know, it, it, which is what Dylan had. You look for something bigger than yourself, and he had for a few years. He got that with Christianity, and then that faded away. And sort of 83 onwards, I just thought he was just going down and down and down and down into the dark. And I saw him on the Petty tour in 87. Just seemed like a soul in torment, you know. Everyone was going, yay, wow, he's done like a Rolling Stone, you know. And, yeah, sure, he had the leather pants on. Yeah, sure, he was had long hair. Sure, he was smoking cigarettes, and, you know. But Dylan's a great transmitter. He has to protect himself. But the way he feels, I think, comes out really directly, which is why we constantly turn to Dylan, because he's emotionally honest. He doesn't necessarily the literal truth, but he tells you the emotional truth, certainly about himself. And I just, you know, I just couldn't listen to them really. That he just sounded so unhappy. And then, you know, he did a lot of covers, didn't seem to be writing songs, kind of scrapey, wretched voice. And then Time Out of Mind came out, and I thought, my God, he really has bottomed out. You know, my initial feeling when I heard that was kind of anger. How can somebody so respected and so admired and, you know, such a pivot for a whole culture to rotate around, you know, how can this man who was the closest thing many of us had to a messiah or a sage or whatever, you know, how can he be so wretched, you know? And then gradually I listened to the record and it sank in and I thought, well, he does feel so wretched, but there's so much in here that he really does. You know, this is it. You have to live with it. We all have our own personal Dylan. And well, it was interesting. It's possible that he'd been taken off drinking drugs. I mean, since then, he's actually been in pretty good shape and he's been pretty high functioning in a way that makes me think he may have had to clean up. But who knows? You know, you've got all those bottles of bourbon he's got, so who knows how sober he is. I mean, basically, Craig, I thought it was a downward graph right the way from Desire down to Good As I've Been to You or something, and then sort of hitting the bottom with Time Out of Mind, but also producing another masterwork, you know, something up there with Blood on the Tracks. I mean, the thing is that his masterworks, none of them is even an echo of a previous one. You know, if Rough and Rowdy Ways is the most recent masterwork, it doesn't bear much relation to Time Out of Mind, which bears very little relation to Blood on the Tracks, which, you know, is a million miles from Blonde on Blonde. So, you know, I see him as constantly moving, I suppose, which is why people, I think, are constantly frustrated by him because they think they've got him. This is my Dylan, you know, but boy, nobody does.
So you're the first interpretation I've heard that sees Time Out of Mind as the bottom as well as a masterpiece, as opposed to kind of the turning point up. Now you may be speaking about, you know, where you think he was personally. I mean, is that a fair separation that musically, oh, yeah, lyrically, you think he turned, but you're reading just as personally, obviously the songs reflect, what was the word Michael Gray had used? Desperation or something is, you know, there's a pervasive negativity through that album.
Well, I think there's been a pervasive negativity through Dylan's work. I mean, Nashville skyline aside, Dylan's stuff is always a bummer. It's just really kind of, it's a very enriching bummer. I mean, I suppose, you know, you could say that so is Samuel Beckett, or, you know, so is those Russian authors, I don't know, you know, Dostoevsky, and I don't know, kind of Thomas Hardy, you know, he is a barrel of laughs, but he's not a vat of sunshine. I think emotionally, Time Out of Mind is about him hitting the bottom, but maybe artistically he was bouncing back. But I'm really more interested in how he feels and how he transmits. I mean, I didn't think the 80s records were bad. I think there were some great songs in them, but I think he still had a ways to go down. You know, Sweetheart Like You, which Emma sings beautifully, I've really got into that because of Emma singing it. When I hear Dylan's version, he just sounds so kind of used. I mean, he sounded like an old man to begin with when he was 21, you know. Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and blowing in the wind. And, you know, they are not. It's not I Want to Hold Your Hand or Surfing USA. It's not even Balloon Man. You know, it's just, oh, my God. Here we go. We're going to go into the dark. We're going to drill through the depths of the human psyche for 60 or 70 years and then, you know, game over. One of the reasons you go to Dylan is because no matter how desperate things are, his work rings true, you know. I do think that he has come through. There was a long period when I think a lot of people felt like he basically peaked in 1966 and the whole thing had been a sort of unraveling, you know. And I think people kind of were saying that perhaps right up until Time Out of Mind or even a bit like, you know, he's that certainly, I think certainly, you know, a lot of British people and the British press and things just thought by the 80s, oh God, you know, it's just, it's over, man. Listen to Subterranean Homesick Blues, you know, don't bother with infidels. And in a way they were right, but I think it was more the vibe of the man himself than actually the songs. And if, you know, there's nothing at all wrong with Sweetheart Like You as a song, it's a brilliant song. That goes all the way through, you know, the unhappiest records have still got some terrific. Maybe We Better Talk This Over, and Senor is a fantastic song.
You can take any of them. I mean, even I'm a Talking TV song fan, for example, Under the Red Sky. I mean, I think that's interesting. The point he makes, which I think reflects this, and it's very fair from his point of view, is don't compare me to myself. You know, put this album against other things, which is hard to do, you know, mentally.
Yeah.
Right. But if you take Infidels against, put line up 5 or 10 albums that were super popular or super regarded by critics in that year and look at Inside Infidels, it's fantastic or many others, but you go, well, it's not Blonde on Blonde and that's, he doesn't like it. And I do think it's fair, but I don't know how you take out human psychology.
I think, don't compare him to himself is a really good point, but it's hard not to. But I think it's a misunderstanding that people tend to have, we tend to have about Dylan. You think you know what it is about him and you think you know what works for you and what doesn't. And that's your business. That's not even his business or the rock writer's business. You know in yourself which records you enjoy more than others. And no one can take that away from you. And it's no good people beating each other up about whether Bringing It All Back Home is better than Desire or Under the Red Sky, you know. It's as good as it means to you. but I think he is genuinely not the same person from one moment to the next. I think he's an extraordinarily changeable protean being. And maybe that's what sort of keeps him vaguely young in a way, is that. And I think also his earlier kind of different incarnations, at least maybe going up to the Christian period, but all that stuff in the 60s, the way he seemed to actually become a different person from record to record. You know, I think he probably was. I think Bowie wore different masks and assimilated different influences. Hey, I'm going to make a soul album, you know, that kind of thing. But I think Dylan actually psychologically probably was, you know, if you'd looked at him under a microscope, you might have found that his molecular structure changed. And, you know, the person you see on the Johnny Cash show in 69 bears no relation to him backstage with Cash in the document. It's like they just don't, there doesn't seem to be a connection. Well, I think that's a pretty unusual gift. And that's something that's hard for most of us to understand, is Dylan's fluidity.
And the voice obviously evolved in many ways, but, you know, you take the Nashville Skyline voice and I've heard like no credible explanation for it, you know, in 50 years. How do you get that voice out of this guy? It seems miraculous.
I don't know. Helium, you know. he said in the interview with Jan Wenner, he said, oh, I stopped smoking. But, you know, I don't think it was that. But he adopted that voice and then it went. It's not like it didn't even sort of ooze in, really. It just suddenly appeared for this one record. The show he did at the Isle of Wight, the things with Johnny Cash, and then by New Morning it was gone. You know, I don't know. I've never seen an interview with, I mean, I'm sure he'd have some, whatever he said would be some kind of deflection.
But, yeah, exactly. So
you know, it might just be possessed by different spirits at different times.
The change in all those masterpieces, those albums that you talked about, obviously is reflected, you know, in the songwriting. To me, those songs on Time Out of Mind, I mean, it set the stage for the next three or four albums. How do you as a songwriter and look at those songs as songs? And then I want to ask you about the production, because obviously on that album, that gets a lot of attention.
As songs, the Time Out of Mind, well, it's interesting because he alternates kind of 12-bar songs, sort of rock and roll, rocky kind of 12-bar songs with, I suppose, what you could call ballads, you know, standing in the doorway and trying to get to heaven and not dark yet and to make you feel my love. And things are all kind of interspersed with things like Cold Iron's Bound or Can't Wait. I can't remember exactly what the order of them is, but it's pretty much blues to ballad alternating, which is an interesting setup. Like, I wonder whether it's interesting that Mississippi didn't make it onto that record, but it made it onto the follow-up, whether he didn't like the arrangement or just didn't feel that there was room for it on Time Out of Mind.
Yeah, I've had this discussion with people. There is a time issue. That was a 72-minute record at the time when it's kind of the first CD record of Bob's. And, you know, with Highlands, if you put on Mississippi, you probably have to lose two things. I'm not sure that's the math you did, but it would be interesting to try to figure out what to take off.
No, I wouldn't take anything off. I know that there were some people were not impressed by the blues numbers, but some of those got to me straight away. And I remember seeing him do Cold Iron's Bound in about 2000 at some British gig and suddenly kind of being pinned back. My God, wow, he sounds like Bob Dylan, you know. And what's he doing at a Dylan show? Because to me, Dylan generally only inhabits himself kind of once, if at all, in shows. The ones I've seen in the last 40 years or so, he's in there for a bit and then he's doing what he does and playing with the band and, you know, making them think they might do a solo and then not do, you know, whatever he does to amuse himself. And then whereas I think he's actually been right back in of late. But no, Cold Iron's Bone was fantastic. And the song that hooked me into it, though, was Not Dark Yet. That was the first thing that I kind of thought, oh, wait a minute. I remember listening to that over and over when Princess Diana was killed and it was just getting dark in Seattle. It was a fantastic, and it was this time of year, so it was that end of summer, you know, here comes the darkness. Not quite yet, you know, and it just fitted absolutely perfectly with that mood. And
coincidentally, I heard that the 25th anniversary of that is today. So you were very quickly on top of the album. It may have been kind of in that period.
Yeah, you're right. So it was. I had a cassette. I had an advanced cassette of it. And that was the one I picked up on then. And then over the next few years, I just realized that often after every gig, I would sit there by myself with a bottle of wine, listening to, it was still on cassette, listening to it, you know. For some reason, I'd always start on, I think, the one after Standing in the Doorway and then go through.
Million Miles?
Yeah, I never really got off on Lovesick. I saw him do it, but I...
Did you have, there was an abbreviated sampler that circulated, or did you have really the full album?
I think I had the full album, and it must have been a long enough cassette to have Highlands, but I had one of those stupid Walkmans that it kind of reversed itself and then you couldn't really tell which way it was going. So it was really hard to wind it forward or back. I just have to let it play and then see. So it was forever. It was hopeless. But the other one I really got into was Highlands, I think. Just because that is absolutely pure Dylan, because it's so sad and not sad, it's just desolate. And he's utterly bummed out, but it's also one of the funniest things he's ever done. It's up there with Clothesline Saga, you know, the range up and touch my shirt. You know, that
right.
One on
yeah, sure.
The tapes, which I always thought was a kind of takeoff of Ode to Billy Joe, but it just... By the time you get to the hard-boiled eggs, you know, it's just, it's great. And I think as a songwriter, that's one of the things I've learned from Dylan and always try to emulate, is to put in really inane lines, comments, scenarios next to whenever, you know, I don't necessarily think, wow, I've got something profound here. But, you know, if I'm going to have some observations about life, or if I'm going to get down deep and dark, and I don't get down as deep and dark as Dylan, I think partly just because I don't have that voice, you know, I've got this sort of middle class British newsreader voice that's not, or, you know, I just don't, that, you know, Dylan has that inflection that just carries with it. It's so nuanced, you know, so ironic.
But yet you're a fantastic interpreter of his songs. So somehow you carry the same songs through, and you've done so many of them and so well.
Well, that's very kind of you. I mean, I think that's because Dylan's my primal influence. I mean, there are other songwriters, particularly the Beatles and John Lennon and all of them really, and Syd Barrett, the man who started Pink Floyd, and Lou Reed and Captain Beefheart and Arthur Lee and all those 60s people, Ray Davis, that whole, pretty much all men, because they're pretty much all from that era, you know. But Dylan was the prime one. So, you know, I've been singing some of those songs. You know, I would have first sung Visions of Johanna in like 1968 when I got my Bob Dylan songbook, and I realized you could do it in three chords. So those songs are so much in my DNA that I couldn't have written them, but they're kind of integral to me, you know.
You have a point about the way Dylan treats his older songs versus his newer on stage that I thought was very interesting.
What I think is that I feel like really the paint doesn't dry on Bob Dylan's compositions. You know, they're there for a while, but then it runs. It doesn't stay the same. Whereas Paul McCartney, I mean, there are other songwriters apart from Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan, but they're both Geminis from the same era, and they're kind of almost completely opposite in approach. Paul McCartney comes up with a perfect arrangement, and then he sticks with that for 60 years. You know, Dylan comes up with what might be a perfect arrangement, but it just melts. It runs away. You know, I think things don't. There's a kind of impermanence about him. But he also accepts change, where again, McCartney fights it off with, you know, facelifts and still being able to deliver the same Beatle Paul, you know, certainly from a couple of hundred yards away that he was 60 years ago. Whereas old Bob makes absolutely no concessions to time, or rather, perhaps that's the reverse. He makes no attempt to resist it. So whenever you see Dylan, he is as old as he is. And you watch the songs, his songs receding into the past, you know, in his rear view mirror and yours. And it's very clear. You can see kind of the layers of time, if you like. You can see these songs through a thickening layer of amber.
Right.
But the songs, like the man himself, kind of mutate. They change over the years. And, there's a kind of realism about that. I mean, I don't think you could do that, say, if you were a classical composer, or even if you were Paul McCartney or Brian Wilson, somebody musically more sophisticated, you couldn't just have it drift like that, you know, or it would be hard to imagine, you know. I mean, imagine if classical music had just mutated, I don't know. And, you know, Beethoven's Ninth when he wrote it, Beethoven's Ninth now. I mean, maybe it has changed, who knows? But Dylan's, I suppose all I'm saying is Dylan isn't really set in stone the way a lot of great work is, you know.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that a little bit, in the idea of what Time Out of Mind represents. You know, many people have said it's kind of the first album made by an older man embracing that and not fighting it. Let me jump back to Time Out of Mind for a minute. How did you feel about the production, for good or bad, and the impact? Obviously, a lot of people think it's overdone. So some of the original reviewers thought his voice was lost in the fog, for example. Mostly now, over time, it's kind of the most celebrated aspect of it, but it's still, you know, very distinct with the vocal amp, the way that Mark Howard processed his voice. But just how you thought about the sound of that album.
oh, I like the sound of it straight away, and I still do. I wish he'd make another record with Daniel Lanois. I thought it was the first time since, I mean, maybe he had a sound when he did the first Christian record, you know, with those guys in Memphis. There was a sort of sound to it. I know he got a Grammy.
Jerry Wexler and...
You know, it was very... It was professionally done in a way that made me feel like he wasn't calling all the shots. And similarly, Blonde on Blonde, Dylan might have been the top cat, you know, but he was dealing with a group of people who were able to sound really good, really fast, and sort of follow the song as he was finishing it. So I think he owed a lot to them in terms of sound. So I'd say both Blonde on Blonde and Slow Train and Time Out of Mind, I think are all good because Dylan isn't in charge of it. And then after that, he does, you know, he's Jack Frost, he's doing, and I feel that one of the problems with Love and Theft and then the one that came after it was there's something a little bit dry in the production. He's just decided he's going to record it really well and that's it, you know, but there's something about getting a producer in. If it works for you, they'll add something. And Lanois added that sort of reverby, swampy, ambient sound with a different guitars coming at different levels. You know, it's as intricate as a Brian Ferry record or something, you know, where they spend ages going over the level.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can sure he wouldn't have had the patience to have, be involved in much of that, but I thought the sound was, I love the sound, and I can hear his voice as much as I can his voice and other things at that time. It's just, if his voice gets lost, it's usually down to his pronunciation, you know, him garbling it.
Mark Howard told us about what was going on there is they recorded the voice straight and through this, what he called a vocal amp, which was something. And then him and Dylan would argue / negotiate which percentage of the overdriven voice and this clean voice, 50-50, 40-60, yeah, whatever. And Dylan, like, you know, he uses Lovesick as an example of where Dylan said, you know, go 70-30. You know, he wanted that heavy. Mm-hmm. But the other interesting thing he mentioned is that many of the musicians that were playing got cut out of the mixes, but they had been leaking into Dylan's vocal amp. So he attributes the swampy, ghosty thing to it's Cindy Cashdollar and Mark and Rubillard and these guys that aren't on the album, except the leakage.
Was that all?
I'll send you the interview. But he and Lanois called those guys the Nashville Strummers, and they didn't want them on the album. So most of Duke's parts and all of Cindy Cashdollar and the guitarist who's back with him, who was there at the time. According to Mark, they pretty much are all gone out of the primary mixes, but the leakage creates the unique sound.
Oh, well, maybe explanation. That's what is more leakage. I don't know. I mean, I think Lanois must take some credit for the whatever he does with the reverb or just the soundscape. You know, it's like if you hear the beginning of Cold Iron's Bound and it's just sort of comes in gradually. It's very ominous. There's little bits of, there's like three different electric guitars. I guess one of them is Dylan, you know, and then it sort of, the landscape builds up and then the voice comes in. And, but maybe also what you say is a factor that what's always great with a record is when there's a sound, but you can't quite tell what it is. Rather than, okay, there's the keyboards, there's the guitar, that's the acoustic guitar, these are the horns, you know. Oh, there's the strings. But actually when you get some weird kind of ambient noise that comes through, you get it in psychedelic music a bit. Just couldn't quite tell what was, something had been put in the background, like a whistle or a shriek or something. I don't know what it is, just some stuff. And I think it's always great when you can't quite tell what you're listening to. Sadly, I say that, but I'm not very good at actually putting that into practice. I've got to make more of an effort to have kind of unidentified things in recordings.
How do you feel about To Make You Feel My Love? In the fan world, there's a lot of consternation about that song. Any thoughts on it?
They think it's too mainstream.
Yeah, schmaltzy is a word you hear, sappy.
Yeah. Well, he's always had an element of schmaltz in there. I mean, well, he hasn't always, but sort of since Nashville Skyline, I guess. Maybe even since I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. You know, it's sort of suddenly a little bit cheesy in a way that Dylan was never really cheesy in the initial phase. He was always too kind of barbed or poignant. You know, Tomorrow Is a Long Time or one of those. I suppose those were tender, but they weren't quite corny. And then I think after I'll Be Your Baby Tonight, there's room for the occasional bit of corn. I don't know, but it's maybe something that got into him in a bit, not really later life, but that would be, he was probably, 26 when he did I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. I like it. I'm sorry, I like that song. And When the Rain Is Falling in Your Face, and that, it's got some quite eerie minor or augmented chords in the middle bit. The rain is out of, the one I could never do you wrong, you know. The middle bit happens twice. But I mean, it's a very kind of predictable chord sequence, but a lot of his sequences are, they're just sort of, I also think it works really well having that there rather than say something like Mississippi, which is terribly rich. There's something about You Feel My Love. It's fairly sparse. You've got the piano. There may not even be any drums on it. So I think sonically it works really well. And then I think you've got, is it Can't Wait? Oh, it's way past midnight. There's people all around.
Yeah. Can't Wait follows it.
Yeah.
So right, it is kind of a palate cleanser before the end. Yeah.
You know, then you've got Highlands, which I imagine on vinyl occupies a whole side and is also probably in some way a sort of like a riposte to Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, you know. You know, a very long song, and instead of Lowlands, it's Highlands. You know, it crossed his mind that he was doing that, and he was ending the album with it. He doesn't go back to the bluesy songs or anything. It's just like, okay, this saga is the end of the record. I mean, also at the end, in a way, it's a kind of slightly optimistic note. You know, he says, I'm already there in my mind, and that's good enough for now. So it's as if he sort of reconciled himself to where he is, and it's sort of like we can only go up from here. Or, you know, maybe we'll carry on going down from here, but, you know, I know who I am, or I know what's fueling me, or, you know, something. No, sorry, short answer, I'm a fan of To Make You Feel My Love, yeah.
The one that the musicians in the room seemed to like that didn't make the record was Red River Shore, that came out on the bootleg series later. Is that one that struck you as a lost masterpiece?
No, I know people I've heard it, but it hasn't struck me. I should go and listen to it. Is that actually from those sessions? That Renoir produced track.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was one that Augie Meyer and the Players thought that was their favorite track that they did.
Oh,
it's very much one of this repeating, droning. You know, I mean, beautiful lyrics on a kind of constant thing. You know, probably an 8-9 minute song.
Oh,
anyway, I was just curious if that it seemed to strike insiders and musicians and artists. They got it, whatever it is, and always seemed to love it. And I just was curious about your.
Well, it could be another of those ones like Blind Willie McTell, you know, that everybody goes, oh, why didn't he use that? And I've never really enjoyed Blind Willie McTell. It sort of just sounds a bit like Hotel California, but I know that's a heretical view to have. But I'm sure it's great. And I dare say a couple of listens, probably if I'd had Red River Shore on my cassette with the rest of them, I'd have, you know, I'd have succumbed to it. I mean, you're very fine, aren't you? Where does it stand for you? That's instead of peak.
I don't think it's a peak. It's certainly a late period peak. Love and Theft is a very strong album. I think your observation is actually dead on, that there's a little something, you know, I wouldn't think of it normally as the production, but it doesn't have that mystery element. but those songs, you know, are fantastic, and it plays like the SACD of that is a very high quality mix. You know, it's lovely. I do favor later period Dylan. I will say I don't go back to the 60s, the original album super often. I think that these 25 years, you know, Love and Theft After has been great. I only picked it to focus on now because it was 25th and it was a good thing to kind of dive into. I actually think we're going to do Street Legal next and spend a couple months diving on that one because no time to think what could be better than that.
Oh, that's interesting. God, I should probably listen to it again, but I sort of feel that that's where he's really beginning to get unhappy as opposed to just angry or, you know, I mean, he was always.
It was the first non-universal acclaim, right? So, I mean, you're reflecting what was in him, but it also resulted in the first mixed reviews and the first some people, you know, it started this period that went all the way until Time Out of Mind. I think it's interesting to step back and look at his career because there's so many pockets you can fall into. But if you zoom back out, you know, there's universal acclaim for 15 or 20 years. There's wandering for 15 or 20 years. And now there's acclaim again for 20 years. And that's a hell of an accomplishment to come back the second time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Well, and there's interesting things all through.
He's a strong man. You know, he's a sensitive man, but he's strong. He's quite tough. He's been able to carry on in that weird, quite isolated position that he's in, that he put himself in. But, you know, he didn't always know what the result was going to be of what he did. He was, I would imagine, trying things out. I don't think he foresaw people's reactions to him at all. He'd have perhaps been more, he might have pulled his punches a bit more, you know.
I think he's said as much, yeah.
And I think the whole, a lot of his career, probably since even before the bike crash, has been about managing people's expectations and kind of navigating through a world that is really quite hard to get through because every time you pass anything, it kind of turns to you, you know. The whole world is sort of heliotropic. It's all sort of, ooh, there you are. You know, if everything you pass by, and not just like, you know, Frank Sinatra and Paul McCartney and everything, they were stars. People just thought, oh my God, look at that. But Dylan was a star who knew something, you know, and that's really frightening.
Yeah, well, you remind me of two quotes. There's Lynn Goldsmith, the photographer who you may know. When she was spending time with Springsteen, but somehow she spent a lot of time near Dylan. And she said, you spend a little time with him and you can't imagine what it must be like for basically every minute of your life for someone to either ask you or tell you you're God. And she was talking exactly about this, that pressure and being compassionate to him of what that must feel like and the impact.
Well, it means it's quite hard to respect people, you know, if they're all going to be like that. And I know of instances of people who run across Dylan and he basically plays with people because he can, you know. There's not many people that would stand up to him who know who he is. And, you know, to some extent he exploits that. He expects them to turn up to his shows and conduct symposiums on him and buy his records and stuff. But it is a very weird position to be in. And I would never want to meet him for precisely that reason, because it would be impossible to be anything like normal with him or vice versa, really, you know?
Yeah. It was somewhat surprising to hear you hadn't and fascinating, but I understand and agree with your take. You know, I always say to people, you know, he gave it the office. I don't need anything from him. I don't want anything. I mean, I'm not in a position necessarily to meet him, but, you know, people always ask, do you want to? And I was like, what could that be? No.
I think, you know, unless he wants to meet you, and even then, if he wants to meet you, it may well be for some sinister purpose that he actually wants to fuck with you in some way. So, I, you know, he's a cat. He plays with people.
Maybe we should talk about your new album for, I know we only have a couple of more minutes.
My record, yeah.
Yeah, so you made it a few years ago, and because of pandemic and album processing, we had to wait till we all heard it.
Well, it was written in 2020, pretty much all recorded at home in Nashville, finished off in London. We did a session at Abbey Road in a sort of strange masked way, and then overdubbed in terms of getting the, Yeah, it just took a long time to finish off. Basic Thing was done pretty much, all done by the end of 2020, but overdubbing, mixing, and then getting it pressed up, you know, because of the lead time for...
You had a lot of remote players, right? A lot of people patched their own pieces on?
We did, but all that was done pretty fast. Most of that was done while I was in Nashville, and I think the last contributions to those probably came through in the end of 2020, a little bit of 21. It was all just, it was the final overdubs, redoing some vocals. You know, Emma was quite, she gave the vocals a good going over, didn't want me to put anything out with us. I can get quite pitchy and people don't tend to let me know that I'm pitchy or I don't notice, you know. So.
It's a lovely sounding record. I like, it was nice to have the vinyl to start with. I mean, that's kind of forces you to listen to vinyl when often these days, you know, you might have vinyl, but you know, you'll throw on the stream because it's moving around with you.
And no, there's no stream. Thank you. No, not yet. No, you could have got to get to know it the old fashioned way through vinyl. And then the cassette will be coming along and the CD. And then I think the streams will be here kind of at Christmas or something, you know, but it's kind of like it's moving through the years. So we're starting with the earliest format. Well, I'm glad you like it. Yeah.
I think it's cool that you guys do cassettes. Do people buy those purely as collectibles or do you find they actually have players?
I don't know. We haven't asked them. I'm sure some people have players. We've got one up there.
All right, Robin. Well, I know we have a time limit, but I do appreciate you helping out and sharing all these thoughts about Time Out of Mind.
Always nice to pontificate about Dylan, you know, chat with fellow Dylanists. And,
all right. Well, Robin, thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts.
Thanks for listening.